cover of the song Islands. Hello and welcome to the final draft books and writing on 2SER. I'm Genevieve McGregor. And tonight we're talking all about islands, those wonderful remote places that harbour some of the most unique landscapes and ecosystems, inspire some of the greatest literary adventures and forays into the human psyche, and in their isolation can hide some of the worst abuses and dirtiest secrets. We talk with two authors who explore this unrestricted nature of islands by drawing on their own experiences. First up, Robert Drew dropped by to talk with Neda Vanavak about the British nuclear tests on the Montebello Islands off the WA coast in the 1950s. And John Dowse chats with Will Mumford about his new novel, To the Highlands, the second edition to his trilogy that chronicles the stages of a young man's development. All coming up, so stay tuned.
Do you have an iPhone? Do you listen to 2SER? Why not listen to 2SER on your iPhone? Download 2SER's iPhone app to hear your favourite programs anywhere, anytime. Visit the App Store and search for 2SER. It's that simple. 2SER, real radio, now on your iPhone.
Robert Drew has been blessed, or is that cursed, with an eventful life. In his first memoir, The Shark Net, he wrote of how a serial killer stalked and murdered several people in his quiet Perth neighbourhood in the 1950s. In Montebello, his follow-up, he focuses on the British nuclear tests at the Montebello Islands off the WA coast that same decade, tracing the effect of the detonations on the sailors and families of those involved, including his own. He recently went on an expedition to the islands with a group of government environmentalists to see how the place is regenerating. From there, he steps into a series of free-flowing tales about his adolescence by the beach, shark attacks, love affairs, midlife crises, his obsession with islands and his early writing career. He came by the studio and Neda asked him how he remembered first hearing about the Montebello Islands.
It was a long while ago and I was only 9 years old, but I was speaking to my mother on the phone one afternoon after school. I was wanting to go to the movies instead of coming straight home. And she said, "No, I want you at home straight away. They've let off a bomb in WA and I want my kids at home right now."
And did you even have any kind of conception at that time of what that meant?
No, absolutely not, and nor did the rest of Australia, because Australia wasn't told about it until it had gone off. No one was asked, electors weren't asked, the cabinet hadn't even been asked, and Prime Minister Menzies had just agreed to a request from the British Prime Minister and said, "Yeah, go ahead, you can let off nuclear bombs in Australia."
So in this book, you go to the Montebello Islands for the first time. What were you looking for?
Well, I wasn't sure. I expected to see sort of nuclear devastation and things. And in fact, because so long has passed now, the islands are more or less as they've always been, except for one island where the major bomb was let off. And that looks as if the bomb had only exploded like a month ago. It looked like a film set of a nuclear test site. The actual site itself where the bomb exploded, all the limestone rocks, the usual limestone rocks of the West Australian coast, had melted and then re-solidified. So they looked like sort of shiny plastic. The vegetation, such as it was didn't even look. There was no trace of green or anything. Even 50 years later, it looked like a piece of old carpet that had been left out in the rain. And there was a dead goanna gesturing theatrically at the sky that looked a bit overdone. It looked as if someone, a production designer, had gone a bit crazy and exaggerated. You know, it looked as you would expect a nuclear test site.
Did you think, once you'd been there, has that put it to rest in your mind, this kind of mystery of what it was and what it meant for Australian history and perhaps the future?
It hasn't put to rest the fact that humans do stupid things and are liable to do that, to have a nuclear test or let off a bomb, you know, any time. It hasn't put that to rest. What it has put to rest is I don't think it would ever happen in Australia again. The electorate is much more savvy and more, less acquiescent to overseas orders in a way. But one thing that did put it to rest was it's now the islands are now being used as the site of a really rather adventurous relocation scheme for animals that are about to become extinct. And on the islands that aren't still radioactive, a team of conservationists from Western Australia are relocating a whole lot of marsupials and birds and reptiles and all sorts of things that would otherwise be extinct, and they're thriving.
You talk in the book about being almost disappointed that it has bounced back so well, as though people aren't going to learn much of a lesson from it because it has regenerated and, you know, almost allowed our stupidity to pass.
Well, the animals haven't learned much. The main turtle breeding site on the whole coast was where the British let off the first and second bombs. And when you fly over that area, you can see the huge crater that was left behind by the first bomb. And the turtles are still coming in there. I mean, tens of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands of them were destroyed. But they're still swimming in as they always did into the same area. So, you know, you think, I guess instinct is greater than, you know, reacting to devastation.
I would love to ask you about your islomania. And you talk about visiting many islands around Australia. And you talk about, well, Rottnest in particular, about being kind of illusory, like a mirage, and that its real charm lies in the nostalgia of youth. Do you feel that way generally about islands, or what's
Well, I feel a special way about Rottnest. I feel more romantically inclined towards Rottnest than I do towards a resort-type island like Hayman Island, as I mentioned in the book, or to a nuclear test site. But islands generally do have a fascination for me. And when I found out there was a term for this, islomania, I guess I'd have to admit to being an islomaniac.
Is that something you'll ever get out of your system?
No, I don't think so. No, I mean, islands are very appealing. It's a very appealing thought to know that not only are you remote from the mainland and everything that goes on in the mainland, and all mainland, certainly when I grew up, mainland's restrictions and moral standards and so forth. It's like a shipboard experience. You know, once you're away from the mainland, you feel anything goes.
The book reads almost like a scrapbook. You sort of dip in and out of the past, your life early on in your career, stories about your families. There's news clippings about devastation in Japan and that kind of thing. Mm. Had you always intended to write it in that style? Was it always going to be a memoir as opposed to perhaps a historical account of...
Oh, yeah, it was always going to be a memoir. And that's the way I like to write memoirs. I mean, my first book, first memoir, was the Sharknet. Dipped back and forth like that too, because I think if you're... if you're thinking of your life or just thinking generally, walking along the street, your mind doesn't just stick on the one topic. You know, life isn't just a constant chronological narrative. I mean, you are sliding backwards and forth with your thoughts, and that's what I wanted to get across really with the book.
Series of segues.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Some of them a bit more hard to see as a segue than others. But yeah, a series of segues is right.
You kind of returned to that fascination with sharks in this book as well, and it was quite affecting the accounts that you gave of the shark attack victims and how they'd survive. I mean, is that particularly a Western Australian fascination, do you think?
Well, it is at the moment, when people are getting eaten at the rate of about one a month. What happened was that, as in the Sharknet, where I felt the marauding serial killer who killed eight people, including a friend of mine, and I found out I knew, you know, not only one of the victims, but my family knew the killer. That series of episodes had a dramatic effect on the psyche of West Australians and on me personally. And Western Australia could be said to have, you know, in that cliche, lost its innocence. But the other thing that affected me was, as growing up, was the experience of my mother being so scared about the bomb going off. So, you know, both those episodes stuck in my mind, and I wanted to write about each of them individually.
Mm. It's like a fear of being hunted almost.
I guess so, yeah.
Mm. You meditate quite a lot in the book when the moments, the turning points in your relationships when they changed tack, your children. Was it a difficult decision for them to allow you to include them?
To write about them.
Yeah. Did you have to ask permission? Or is that kind of something that comes with the territory?
Considering their feelings comes with the territory. I don't say you're going to be in this book, is that okay? But I do. It is in my mind all the time, how will this go down, will it affect them and so forth.
And how honest can you be?
I probably, with family and loved ones, I probably withdraw a little bit, because that's really more important than getting it all down. If I were to write the absolute truth about some members of my family, it would be, you know, a searing expose, really.
You talk a lot about your early career and finding your feet as a journalist, and you wrote that you often told people that you were a writer. That you were a journalist and not a writer. And I wondered if you still felt that way, that it's easier to get away with saying that you're a reporter rather than a novelist.
When asked by a taxi driver or something, what do you do?
Well, anyone.
Yeah. Now, these days I say what I do. I mean, I've been doing it for decades. So if someone asks what I do for a living, I say I'm a writer. But it took a while.
What point did you settle into that?
Only after about four books, I think. And part of it was that Australian thing of always being wanting not to appear elitist, you know, not wanting to put on the dog and things. But then, if you did say you were a writer, then they'd say, "Oh, have I heard of you?" Which is unanswerable.
It's a hideous question.
And then they say, "Should I have heard of you?" So it's best to just say, "No, I'm a reporter." Mm. And in a sense, if you're a writer of any sort, you're an observer. You are, you know, you're reporting on life.
That was Fleet Foxes with Mykonos, and tonight we're talking all about islands on the final draft. Coming up, an interview all about the escape from order and restrictions, so stay tuned.
It's live, it's blue, it's the 2SER website. Log on to www.2ser.com for program guides, radio info, events, special offers, discounts and freebies. While you're there, show your support by subscribing online. And with live streaming, you can listen anywhere in the world. That's www.2ser.com. Designed by Digital Eskimo. 2SER. Real radio.
Get worded up with Final Draft. Books, writing and publishing. Mondays at 7 p.m. on 2SER. 107.3.
I'm a book. I'm a book.
John Doust's To the Highlands is the second edition to a trilogy of part memoir, part fiction novels, which chronicle the stages of a young man's development. Fresh from high school, Jack is sent off to the islands as an immature, unaccomplished failure, and arrives in a world without the restrictions and order he's used to. Final Draft's Will Mumford chatted with John about the pointlessness of inverted commas, the charm of Australian profanity, and the parallels between his own experiences as a young man and those of his protagonist, Jack.
You can't really know a theme in your life while you're living it. You look back, and so I've developed themes that were unknown to me, threads that were unknown to me. And in essence, I, as a young man and as a dysfunctional young 19-year-old, was sent to Papua New Guinea by the Bank of New South Wales. I spent a month in Port Moresby, where I behaved badly with three other young men, and we were told by the bank that we would be expelled to various parts of the country to keep each other away from each other. I went up to a place up in the Eastern Highlands. I was put on a statement machine, and in the book I've taken advantage of the statement machine to emphasise the sexism of the time. I don't remember feeling bad because I was working a job that was essentially a woman's job, because I knew when I was sent to the Highlands that I was going to an all-male office. Women were not sent to remote locations. So those sort of differences I've either emphasised or created as bits of fiction to emphasise, if you like, a greater truth.
The two fictional letters that are transcribed at the start of the book suggest that Jack was quite scarred from his experience on the island, both mentally and physically. Was it the same for you when you returned to Australia?
Yes, it was very much so. In the book, I really have Jack experiencing the worst of it. I, in fact, had a breakdown after I came home. My breakdown kind of took place over the 3 or 4 months after I arrived back from Papua New Guinea, whereas I've really forced the breakdown on Jack in the place. But, yeah, it scarred me deeply. Many things stayed with me, obviously, and that's why I had to write the book. Neither book came easy to me in the process. I don't write easy. I love writing. I'm driven to write, but I write with great difficulty in that it disturbs me. I reconnect with the disturbance, and I write, in fact, in a disturbed state, which is not comfortable, in particular for those who live with me and love me. To me, the story is too important for me to worry about any kind of dysfunction I might have to fall into.
But it's somewhat traumatic to go through the process of regurgitating that kind of personal material.
Yes, it is. I think that if a writer, and I am such a writer, who digs into his own personal life to create his works, and there is misery, there is depression, there's violence, there's uncomfortable periods in those early lives, then the reworking of them is inevitably going to cause pain.
There is an appeal to a certain version of masculinity and a certain lifestyle by the characters that live on the island in the book, and one that I'm sure you would have experienced yourself, with lots of heavy drinking and sex and exploitation. Did you see issues with that way of living?
I think collectively we are unable to recognise that a man, in order to be whole, must be all things, if you like. If we just take two extremes, the hard man and the soft man, then we must be able to embrace both sides. I remember my father, when my mother broke both her hips and my father became her sole carer. And my father was a country man, and he talked with his lips close together, and he on his said something when he had something to say, unless he'd had a few beers. And I remember spending time with them, and he had to do everything for my mother, but he'd pick her up out of bed and put her back in the bed like she was a bag of wheat. And I'd say, Dad, she's try a little. Oh, well, I've got to get the bloody woman out of bed. I've got to do everything for her. And I tried to explain to him that, you know, this warrior man that he'd been all his life was great, and it was wonderful, and it helped us get through difficult times, and it was the man who stood up for his friends and stood up in the bar, in the front bar, and said, don't you talk to my mate like that. So, but now you're caring for your wife. We don't need that guy. We need some other kind of hero, some other kind of archetype. We need a caring, soft man. If you look, I have a great fascination for Rome, and among there's five guys they call the five good emperors, and they start with a fellow called Nerva, and they run through people like Trajan and Hadrian and Marcus Aurelius. And there are a couple of things that all these guys have in common. One is that they were all great warriors. The second is that they're all great lovers of art and literature. The other thing is that they were all homosexual. But, you know, collectively, we don't get that. We still have a fear of the soft man, you know, of the strong woman.
You write without standard punctuation, which is obviously an unconventional way of writing. Is that just part of your style?
Yeah, I do. I find punctuation. You mean the quotation marks?
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, not all punctuation.
No, I love punctuation, in fact, because it's part of the music. But quotation marks, no, they annoy me. I don't know. I can't remember the first book I read without them, but I remember reading and thinking, my, this is it. This is the way to do it. We don't need those silly little things on hanging off the roof. So, I don't write with them at all, no. I dislike them. I find them intrusive.
Intrusive for the reader or for the writer?
Well, as a reader, I don't like them. As a writer, they're just so bloody annoying. At the end of everything, you've got to think now, does it go before the comma? Does it go after the comma? I don't know where the hell they go. Which way do they go? Do they go this way? Do they go that way? It's an encumbrance. It stops the flow. For me, the writer, it hinders my flow. I naturally place commas and full stops where they belong. My punctuation is pretty good. My editor likes my punctuation. My spelling sometimes leaves a bit to be desired. But quotation marks. No, let's dump them.
Fair enough. What stuck most with me from reading this book was that it truly is an expose of the beauty, I think, of Australian profanity. Would you agree that our worst language is in some ways also our most charming?
Yes. I do. I think a lot of people, of course, if you think about our greatest exponent politically, Paul Keating, many, of course, love him, and many, probably just as many, hate him. He fascinated me and sometimes enthralled me. We have this thing about the tall poppy. I think it's good. It can, of course, go too far. If you insult someone too often, it can, of course, scar. But I think in general, I like it. I come from a small town in WA, a little bit further north of Albany, and when I drive into that town and I open my car door and I get out, I expect that at least three of the first people who see me will insult me, because they want to remind me where I came from. It doesn't matter how big you get, Jono, you're from this town. You grew up and there was only 900 people. You're one of us. Don't forget it. And I quite like that.
The contempt for ambition.
Yes, exactly. My father was a classic exponent. If you came home and you got a damn good mark on your report, he would rip the rug out from under you pretty damn quick. So I think we're both very good at mocking others, but we're also very good at mocking ourselves.
That was Will Mumford speaking with John Doust about his latest novel, To the Highlands. Now, a little something to bring us home. Regular listeners may remember my interview with jazz drummer and poet Alan Brown earlier this year. This is him reading his poem, The Three Little Bops, which features in his first collection of poetry, Conjurer.
In my house live
three little bops. I love them all too, as they bop around me, scatting. The littlest, Haley Bob, is out, far, far out. She digs her sister's tunes, improvising lyrics. To pie me a pony, jigger jig, dog dig, or fairer, darker, come boo. The middle Bob is also cute. She's dark and passionate. She knows the songs, has big ears and great time. She really cooks. As does Mummy Bob, just a chicken though, with curvy legs and a tender breast, driving me wild with her wails. As Aretha turns her on in the cans. I'm gone, man. A bop raptured daddy-o.
That's all we have time for tonight. You can download tonight's podcast by going to 2ser.com and following the links to The Final Draft. Netta and I will be back together on the air next week to talk animals. From zombies to chickens, we've got it all, so tune in next Monday from 7 p.m. And to finish off tonight, I thought I'd give you a taste of the animal mania that you can expect next week. A song from one of our feature albums, I'm an Ape by David Byrne and St. Vincent. The Wonderful on the Corner is up next, so stay tuned. Thanks for listening.
Looking for people to join its team of dedicated volunteers.
With a proud 30-year history, 2SER is Sydney's best and most diverse radio station.
There are many ways you can take part, from working in our award-winning newsroom to producing breakfast to working behind the scenes.
There are countless ways you can contribute.
So if volunteering at 2SER is something you'd like to do, then go to www.2ser.com to find out how.